I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hello and welcome to What Most People Think, the podcast that tries to get somewhere near the middle ground of what ordinary people think about the news and topical events and culture and all that sort of stuff. And to that end, this week, I think I've got a very good candidate for that. I've got returning guest Jacob Hawley. First up, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. Good to be introduced as a middle of the road man.
Well, it just occurred to me that you grew up in Stevenage, and I kind of thought that in a way, elections, they sort of say like working to man, Mondeo man.
Yeah.
I think Stevenage man is probably a good guide of where the country's at.
Do you know where it was used recently, where I heard someone using it? Tyson Fury used it disparagingly to describe the kind of person who criticised him on the internet. He was like, I don't care what Steve from Stevenage thinks of me. I'm a world champion. Have you got nothing to say to me? And I think that does sum us up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, never take our opinions too seriously and don't let us get above our station.
Well, he could have also gone on Pete from Peterborough.
Yeah,
Colin from Colin Dale. He might just been an appealing repetition to Tyson. You know, he loves language. He loves language.
He's known as a linguist, Mr. Tyson Fury.
I mean, you were there. You did the opening when I did my tour show in Stevenage, the one that's on ITVX. And I said about Stevenage, it's been quoted back to me a few times now. It's got everything that you need and nothing that you want. Is that fair?
That, do you know what? That evening was a really big deal to me. That was a really special night to me to perform at the Gordon Craig, where I'd seen so many pantomimes over the years. Yes, nothing you would want kind of sums it up. It's a brutalist town centre, Stevenage. I saw it in one of those sort of viral videos of people putting flags up and then tripping over their own shoelaces last week. Which is
going to the Tommy March?
No, it was. I mean, this is how quickly the news has moved. It was pre Tommy March. It was when it was still sort of flag stuff.
Oh, right. Of course, yeah. You know,
yeah. Videos of people putting flags up, and then even more annoying people demanding that the flags are taken down. There was one of them set in Stevenage Town Centre. I think they got the flag wrong. I think they might have put it up wrong, and it sort of waved down or something. Yeah, I don't know. Not a proud moment for Stevenage, no matter how it went.
Well, we are going to talk, we mentioned there about marches and flags and all that sort of stuff. So let's tell you what is in the show today. Protests might happen because Donald Trump is coming to Britain. We're recording this at 11 a.m. on the Monday, so he's coming Tuesday night. So we're going to talk about potential flashpoints, predictions, where it might go, whether or not Keir Starmer will have slept at all in the last week. We'll be talking also about the continuing fallout from Peter Mandelson sacking, some backbenchers. Richard Bergen, big Richard Bergen's weighed in with a prediction that Starmer might not make it until, well, much after May 2026. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to reflect on the sad death of Ricky Hatton. And, you know, we haven't done any men's mental health for a while, but just talking about how blokes need to check in on each other. But equally, you know, sometimes people are in such a bad place that even that might not make the difference. And then in the Patreon only, with the continuing fallout also from Charlie Kirk's murder, I'm going to get Jacob's thoughts about millennials and, you know, well, it did seem to be largely younger people celebrating things online. And if we have time, we'll do a little bit on the Unite the Kingdom march for Saturday. Okay, new patrons. So I did say this in Friday's breaking news show, but I now front the production costs for this podcast entirely. So if you more patrons helps keep it regular, think of it like fiber, all right? You becoming a patron is like putting Weetabix in. Oh, that's a gross analogy, but you get my point, right? You get my point. We got a couple of new ones, Jacob, and you know that we roast the names here. This guy, apparently he's been a patron. He's been a VIP for a couple of months, and I didn't shout him out, which is criminal. But his name is Charlie Coots.
Charlie Coots?
Yeah.
That's a very similar surname to David Coote, the ex-Premier League referee who was initially in trouble for going on a night out and has now been accused or maybe even charged of
sexual... I think charge of making indecent images of children. Yeah.
If my surname was that similar to a man who'd been done for stuff like that, I don't think I'd be demanding that you shout me out on your podcast. I think I'd just have you lay low.
It'd be like if you join my Patreon as Jacob Hitler, you might go, you know what? I work for the council. Maybe don't say my name.
Yeah.
Charlie Coots also as well. He does sound like a peripheral figure in the murder of Jack the Hat McVitie as well.
Yeah, there's something mystery about it. It's a bit Pink Panther, isn't it, Charlie Coots? Feels like he'd get chased around Paris for trying to kill an MP or something.
It could be a lot of things, Charlie Coots. I mean, he'll now regret asking me to roast him, but it could be a lot of things as well. Charlie Coots could also be a designer as well. The new Charlie Coots range did a show at the Paris thing and had loads of models smoking. Smoking's back. It'll be one of those ones.
I could
ones
see people wearing Coots. The Charlie part of it as well adds a sort of infantile nature to it. It feels like a kid at Dennis the Menace's school who would have seen himself as a bit of a fashion designer, and Dennis and his mates would have bullied him for that.
Yeah, for showing designs of creativity and femininity. That won't be tolerated. We also have Guy Woodford, who just sounds like a real kind of circuit DJ, been doing it years, absolutely open for all the greats, for Van Dyke, Carl Cox. Guy Woodford opened up with a beautiful melodic tech house set, 90 minutes, just pure Guy Woodford. Pure Guy Woodford, that's his podcast.
Guy Woodford as well, that could also be like a sort of a witness in a small town case. Do you know what I mean? We spoke to Guy Woodford, who was there on the scene, but says there wasn't too much to go by in terms of the appearance of the killer.
He would be the guy. So, you know, you're 60 minutes into a Netflix doc about a murder.
Yeah.
And you'll have heard him mentioned, then suddenly he suddenly sits down and puts on his mic, you know, in the way that all documentaries do. Now we have to see them getting mic'd up for some reason.
Yeah, borderline reluctant to do it. So, oh, well, you know, it was obviously a hard time in the town for me and everyone else, but obviously it's important to speak to you guys about what we went through, Guy Woodford there. Thank you.
Yeah, he's like, okay, let's begin.
Yeah.
The main talking point, David Demain, our super patron who keeps an eye on previous week's episodes and comes back to me on one or two things. We were talking with Scott Capurro. By the way, I think a lot of people enjoyed the Scott Capurro episode because, as you know, Jacob, Scott Capurro is one of the most uncompromising comics. Just man does not give a fuck.
Yeah.
So I think that people kind of enjoyed me squirming from time to time and having to dissociate myself from his comments about the royal family. But they stayed in.
Those times radio produced. Is getting anxious as they listen to your podcast every week.
Listen, when we met, they knew that I already had another child, which is the podcast. We talk about the difference between sarcasm and irony. Simon Pegg, he said, Simon Pegg wrote a brilliant article on how Americans understand irony. This paragraph, David says, from Mr. Pegg is the highlight. Although it is true that we British do use irony a little more often than our special friends in the US, it's like the kettle to us. It's always on, whistling slyly in the corner of our daily interactions. To Americans, however, it's more like a nice teapot, something to be used, but only when the occasion demands it. I mean, sarcasm and irony, I suppose they do have a relationship with each other, but do we use it more because it's just a neat way of not saying what we really feel, and we're British and that's ultimately what we want to do?
I don't know if I agree on the, I think the sarcasm thing, definitely. I think, because the thing is, sarcasm is a sort of, by default, it's quite a negative thing. Do you know what I mean? It sort of goes with the weather. It's, oh, God, looking forward to lunchtime already. Do you know, like that sort of default negativity that matches the rain in the UK. I think it's just sarcasm just washes over you.
It's like phrases like, nice weather for ducks.
Yeah.
And America might go, God, you're right. That's a really nice way of looking
enjoy
at
it today. Yeah.
Yeah. Like sometimes I get so wrapped up in myself and I remember that we need rain. And you're like, no, what I mean is it's pissing down and I'm really unhappy about it.
That's it with Americans. It's more that they're so prone to earnestness. They take everything so serious. Like there have been times, and this might make you squirm a little bit. I've got a couple of girls who are going out with American guys. And the sort of earnestness and the sincerity, my brain makes me think they might be autistic. Do you know what I mean? That sort of immediately like, right, okay, let's engage in this conversation. It's like, no, mate, I was making an offhand comment. I was willing to just sort of move on now. They're like, oh, what did you mean by that?
Well, yeah, because that used to be associated with Asperger's, was the literalness, taking things literally.
That's until, it, yeah.
Until we don't use Asperger's apparently, because apparently Asperger's himself was a bit of a Nazi, and there's been basically an aggressive takeover of autism. It's kind of bought out. You know, in the same way that Disney now owns all the big studios.
That's
it.
Everything's just autism now. It's got a monopoly over intensity and earnestness.
I do like a bit of sarcasm, and but sometimes you can mistake it and it can be hurtful. I remember I did Richard Herring's Edinburgh podcast when he used to go up there with the show, and I went and did a 5-minute set. I did some stuff about why we should be more proud to be English, not in a kind of, you know, unite the kingdom way, but, you know, just some jokes about it. And it went, it was a bit dodgy. And as I was coming off, he went, that was brave. And in a moment, I was like, oh, yeah, I get it. When someone says that was brave, a British person means that they think you've made a terrible decision. Yep. Scott also said that Reform didn't have any policies. I think we both sort of concurred with that idea. And David, you know, I want to be fact-checked. And David has correctly come back and said that Reform do have policies. And I just had a look at the link that he sent me. And one of them is he thinks that a tax-free allowance for income tax should be 20 grand. Now, it's interesting with the income tax threshold, because when Labour went out of power in 2010, it was only like six and a bit grand, right?
Yeah.
Tories quite quickly pushed up to 12 and a half. And when people wondered why a lot of working class people voted for them in 2015, that might have been one of the reasons, right? And then so Reform is saying it should go to 20 grand. Now, I mean, I get why they would say that, because it helps them out in the red wall and the places that they think they could win. But there is a part of me that sort of thinks, I think we should all be paying in a bit of tax. It's like having a steak, isn't it? It's almost like buying your silence for you to not have to pay tax on any level.
You really are drifting left now, aren't you? The way I was talking to someone about this on the podcast, they were asking me about opening for you and stuff. And I was saying that, like, the way the country is drifting so far right, as a kind of like centre-right commenter, you're becoming the sort of soft lefty of political commentary now.
I haven't changed. All that's happened is the Overton window's moved, like just gone sailing past me.
But this is the country has moved around you. This is what I mean. Is I think the country, even though we've in theory gone from a sort of right wing government to a left wing government, and I think you could argue the toss on that both ways. But like in terms of public opinion and what people are willing to be outspoken about, you've become like kind old Uncle Jeff.
Well, the thing is, but I would argue that thinking everyone should pay tax is potentially also right wing. You know, like I think all tax should be 20% for everybody, right? I think that that's clean. It still means that the rich pay more, but there's a cleanness to that. But back when I first started to talk about my politics, thinking that kind of stuff was the radical view before the cultural stuff changed. Now, what people see as right wing is all cultural, isn't it? It's about immigration, it's about identity, flag, family, all that sort of stuff. But oh, mate, in the heady days of 2013, believing that the rich shouldn't pay any more tax, that, mate, I was a fucking edgelord back in those days.
Oh, you were a monster. You were a monster.
Now, that's at the light end. That's at the light end. Most people think. So the thank you. And as I say, we will talk again in the patron-only section about Charlie Kirk, but Bob Villain, right? So if you remember Bob Villain, he was the deaf to the IDF guy at Glastonbury. And I was sort of thinking, it's kind of weird that he hasn't weighed in on this because, you know, the guy has PR instincts. Let's put it that way.
It's almost like he's had 15 minutes of fame, Jeff, and they might be up now.
Well, but that was what I thought. I thought he'll weigh in on this because he's realised that that's the way that he gets attention and maybe sells tickets. So he did this gig in Holland, right? And he's riffing between songs like he does, you know, like he's like the Rat Pack, you know, except
in loads of ways. I reckon loads of people have made that comparison in the past.
Yeah, he's Dean Martin. He's a left-wing Dean Martin, you know, except he calls for death to things. So he starts talking about euphemistically about what's happened. He says, oh, his pronouns are now were, was, like past edge. Like, ooh. But he hasn't said Charlie Kirk's name right. Then he says, well, you know, he says something about chat shit, get banged, which is a kind of younger sort of working class millennial type phrase, Gen Z phrase, which means that if you say things are out of line, there'll be consequences. It often relates to violence. You sort of think, well, I guess he still, if he's playing this smartly, could claim that he's not talking about anything specifically. And just in case you're in any doubt, he then goes, rest in peace, Charlie Kirk, you piece of shit. Now, I mean, I said it on Friday's show. I think all these things celebrating other people's killing is fucking dismal. And like I say, we'll get onto that. What I can't understand is how he can't see the circular logic of the chat shit, get banged argument. Even if you're just thinking from, like, forget his, like, lack of empathy and his hatred and all that sort of stuff, that he can't see that goes around, right? Because the simple next extension of that is, what if someone thinks you're chatting shit?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's so obviously the next stop on this fucking tube line. But yeah, I just wanted to say, like I said, it was just a quick stop on that. thank you to Bob Villain for satisfying my instincts. I was going to go to the bookies and say, can I stick a tenner on Bob Villain at some point weighing in on this? And of course he did. Jacob, what is the fuck you?
My fuck you, and this is, I think I'm probably playing to your crowd a little bit here. It is specifically about the British High Street, and it is specifically about seaside towns no longer having as many fish and chip shops as they used to. I don't know about you, when you do a gig in a seaside town, do you promise yourself some chips for the way home on the train?
Of course, yeah.
Even in the car. Do you know the worst culprit for this is Brighton? You go to Brighton, and I'll always get a train home from Brighton. Always think to myself, I'm on the train home, big bag of chips, few beers, Thameslink train, plenty of space, not going to annoy anyone with the smell. Perfect. Mate, that walk to the station, two kebab shops, fine. Chinese restaurant, don't know who's taking that away to the train station. And then Belgian chips. Belgian chips in Brighton. Who wants that?
Jacob, I could see this speech getting played out at the next Unite the Right march. Belgian chips.
But listen, look, I don't think many of us have got a massive issue with the Belgian people, right? And there was around 2016, there was some kind of anti-Brussels stuff, but that was less about Belgian people and more about government, right?
Yeah.
I like the Belgian people. I've got plenty of time for, there's some good mussels and Belgian beers restaurants in central London.
You hate Belgians. Right. Jacob, it's fine. You hate Belgians.
I will say there is a time and a place for Belgians, and the time is negligible, but the place
is 1914.
Yeah. I just can't believe it. I was walking up to Brighton. I've done a few shows in Brighton recently, hence this has got my go. There's just, you cannot get a bag of like fish and chip shop chips for the train home. It is madness. I can't believe it.
And a lot of chip shops as well have diversified to the point of making it meaningless that they're a chip
this
shop.
Is
you
it.
Go, just own what you are. But weirdly, the place that where there's more fish and chip shops now than ever, central London. They're popping up everywhere because they realise that tourists come over here and want it. And they're so like new, but they've got like old Jimmy Smith's fish and chips.
This is it.
Like,
yeah.
Established 2018. And it's like 19 quid for cod and chips.
19 quid for cod and chips. That like none of the staff there are older than 23. And none of them are called like Old Martin. None of them are like, you know, Smiths and Sons. They're all students.
Yeah, yeah. They're not about that life. But I bet you any money what they'll have. And this is probably where even they get a prick like me where they go, they've got four different kinds of vinegar. I go, four? I didn't even know there was four. All right, I'll throw 20 quid at cod and chips, no worries.
Yeah, that's got me in.
Okay, from cod and chips, I hope Donald Trump is up for a bit of cod and chips because his state visit starts, as we talk, it starts tomorrow night. So let's talk about that.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
So, Jacob, first thing I want to say is this visit happening this early into Trump's reign, and I will call it a reign, is it premature, first thing? Because it happened in the context of after the Oval Office bust-up with Trump and Zelensky, Starmer went over there. It seemed like he was shitting himself that Trump was going to mug him off in public. And look, let's be fair to him, probably wanted to put sort of smooth out the waters a little bit. So within seconds, he's gone, I've got a letter from the king, and he just pulls it out straight away. On reflection, given all the international challenges, should he have just kept that up his sleeve a little bit longer? Because this is so early. What have we got after this to bribe Trump with?
But this is Starmer's thing. He's overly eager with stuff like this all the time. He's the word that my mates from home would use is beggy. Starmer's a beggy guy, isn't he? And I think, especially when you get someone like Trump, who I think can be a bit of a bully sometimes and enjoys that sort of power dynamic, the more you beg to him, the less he's going to come to you. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like he's played all of his cards too early. He also had that embarrassing interaction where Trump started calling out Sadiq Khan last time. in front of him, and he's, oh, that's my friend, actually. No, please.
I'd like to talk about a friend. To be honest, even that I thought was more than I expected Starmer to do. I thought he'd just sit there and act like he'd got an email that he had to read and got, oh, well, what's been happening for the last couple of minutes? I zoned out a little bit.
There's a little bit of him where he's like, well, I do kind of have to back Sadiq a little bit, but I have to try and do it in a friendly way. And then that went embarrassingly wrong. I mean, it's the sort of question is like, who could Trump go after now? Do you know what I mean? He mugged off Sadiq last time. Who could he get this time? I mean, the problem is the most obvious one would be Mandelson, who I know we're going to talk about later. Trump can't take the mick out of Mandelson because Trump's probably on Epstein's list as well.
He'll probably do like a really tricky one, like Martin Lewis. And the British people go, if you do not back him now, Starmer, you're out.
This is it. He's our last bastion of reliability.
Something we pretty much all agree on. I mean, they're going to Windsor Castle. They're going to Windsor Castle for the visit. Even that, in a way, seems strategic because if you're Buckingham Palace, you're centre of London, there's probably going to be a lot more protests. Whereas a part of the modern protest crowd, I feel like if they can't get there on their Oyster crowd, they ain't going, right? And Windsor Castle is a ball ache to get to.
And none of them are there. You don't get blue-haired people with placards living in places like Windsor. Do you know what I mean? There's no branch of London School of Art out there. There's no reason for them to be there. It's too expensive on the Oyster, as you say. You cut, like, trains backs are difficult.
You've got to walk up a hill.
You got to walk
get,
up
to get
hill.
To the castle.
I've been to protests before to impress girls. And let me tell you now, you're not doing anything. You're not doing anything that's tiring or difficult. You're doing things that are easy and there's potential for train beers on the way home. And I reckon they've looked at that train line. It's not happening.
And you're adjacent to a nearby Five Guys. That's all the protest crowd asks. I mean, I did wonder, like, about how Willie, because he's so thin-skinned, Trump, right? He genuinely, bless him, he does get genuinely upset when people don't like it fucking hurts the man. So if there is a protest, and God knows how they do it, I don't know, there might be some drones, you know, there's going to be something that's going to happen, probably more than one thing. That is the moment of key peril for Starmer, isn't it? Because he will then shoot from the hip. He'll start saying, you got some bad people in this country here, bad people, nasty. Yeah, you got, I said to him, you got to do a better job, maybe deport them to the Isle of Wight. You know, he'll just come up with some old shit. And that is the moment, I think, of extreme peril, right? Is if there is protest, how does Trump react and how does Starmer react to the reaction?
Well, this is the thing, and I think Starmer will be trying to sort of tell off the people that are protesting, and it will feel like a substitute teacher is being embarrassed in front of the headmaster. Do you know what I mean? The headmaster's come in, the substitute teacher clearly doesn't have control of anyone, and they start shrieking and shouting and threatening punishments that everyone knows aren't going to happen. Someone's going to go to jail for a tweet again, and before you know it...
Yeah, they will. There'll be one of those. Jesus Christ, I mean...
I reckon she'll be in the jungle this year. That woman who went to jail for a tweet.
Who, Lucy Connolly?
That's if I'm the bookers for I'm a Celeb, I'm sticking her in the jungle.
Yeah, because there has been like a recent history on reality shows of putting figures from the cultural or political right into reality shows. So we had Nigel Farage, we had Matt Hancock, we got Thomas Skinner on Strictly, right?
Well, so just hanging on by a thread, Skinner, because he's had all the affair stuff came out over the weekend and indeed today.
Oh, right. Oh, I missed that story. So that was why he had that bust up with the journalist.
It hasn't been confirmed that was why, but he did a in-person interview. I like how we've pivoted from Trump to Skinner in seconds.
It's what this podcast is all about,
this
mate.
This is it. And he's if anyone's going to take over as the next leader of the UK, it genuinely might be Tom Skinner at this rate.
I mean, that is quite an achievement for an affair to come out before Strictly. Normally with Strictly, it's kind of week four of grinding up against each other doing the Paso Doble.
Yeah.
In trouble.
This is it.
The other potential flashpoint is with the king himself, right? Because the king, quite lefty, talks to the plants. We know this about him, right? He doesn't like buildings.
Yeah.
I'm sort of summarising to a large degree here.
Yeah.
But he's seen to be on the sort of progressive left, maybe in that old kind of like 1970s type way. I'd say he likes a drink. I mean, just looking at the skin, the redness
fingers.
Of face.
The fingers are a giveaway. That's a drinker's hand.
Yeah, he looks like he likes a drink. So I'm just wondering, I mean, Trump will be reasonably deferential. What if the flashpoint comes from Charlie himself? that he just goes, oh, fuck off. You know, just like there'll be some point in the dinner. Because I know somebody that did a bit of work with the king and said, like, he doesn't like, a bit like Trump, doesn't like being contradicted and sees himself as knowledgeable. So what if the king just kind of like, there's a point made about vaccine or something, well, and the king just...
His thing is a green thing, isn't it? It's sort of what you're getting to with the progressive left stuff. I do think he might have said some kind of racist comment in the past that was picked up. So I'm not sure he's the uber leftist that Zach Polanski might
have. Oh, so they could bond over that kind of stuff.
This
you know?
Is it. They could bond over racism, but it's as soon as they start talking about trees and plants and deforestation that they're going to fall out with one another.
It's so funny when you think about the prep for these events. It must go right down to the granular to like, and we think, we've had a chat in the team here. We think areas to stay away from include windmills and blue hair. We just don't discuss blue hair. Or windmills. Everything else is play. A lot of complimenting of each other's wives. I mean, that is the thing. They are that Trump and the king where they compliment each other's wives because they think that's like a really kind thing to do.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're of that age. They're of that age where the fact that neither of them is a widow yet is something to compliment. Do you know what I mean? You've still got yours. Right. I've still got mine. We're both holding on to them. We're clearly looking after them. That's
I mean, Trump did slightly help that by going about 40 years younger, but strategic. I mean, just one final thing of this is with Starmer. I wonder, this is where I have some empathy with, well, quite a lot with people in politics. In the week leading up to this, right? I mean, he's got loads of shit going on with Mandelson, which we'll come to in a minute. How do you sleep at all in the week leading up to this? All it's not just like one moment where you got to press flesh and grin for the cameras before like a summit or something. It's like a few days of having like a house visit from the most volatile family member you can imagine. I mean, do you think Starmer's been having dreams about like Trump bouncing him on his knee in 4 years?
It's
the
volatility,
press?
Isn't it? It's this is the thing. He must be looking at like previous prime ministers and going, "You had it so lucky in comparison." Yeah. Biden turns up; he's barely awake. You know what I mean? He's like, no one was worried about Biden. It's like he'll smile at the right time. They'll wake him up for the photographs. The rest of the time, it's groovy. He's got someone who could say anything.
Could say anything. I mean, David Cameron had Obama. Flipping burgers with Obama had to be
dream.
Sort of like the apex. Might Bill Clinton come over?
Even and, you know, Bush. Even Bush, it's easy enough. Play a bit of golf with him. You know what I mean? It's not hard. Just keep him sweet. You know, you agree that you're going to do whatever he wants with Iraq. It's sweet. This could go anywhere. This could, like, you've got no idea which way Trump might go.
Yeah. On that note, it's Monday a day. There's something tells me that I'll be doing another podcast later this week. Okay, we're going to talk a bit about Mandelson. So just a recap of where we're at with that. Stuff starts swirling on Tuesday. Mandelson gives an interview with Harry Cole of The Sun to get out ahead of it. I think that's always a sign that something's going wrong there. If someone's like said, can we do an interview? Can I tell you stuff? Wednesday at PMQs, Badenoch really put Starmer in a corner. Did you watch any of that PMQs, by the way, Jacob?
I saw clips of that. And I have to say, I'm starting to really respect Kemi with stuff like that. I think she's really good with stuff like that.
She should do it more often. I mean, what she did was she stayed on one subject and she got him so spun around that at one point he asked her why she didn't ask him more questions about Angela Rayner last week, where you just thought, geezer's fucking shot. Like, as the youngsters would say, he's cooked. So then on Thursday, these emails come out. And I would urge people to read them. They're creepy as fuck, these emails between Mandelson and Epstein. Now, if I think I've got this right, a lot of the perception now is that these happened when everything was known about Epstein. But things came out bit by bit. I think at the time that these emails happened, he was just Jacob. Just a convicted sex offender. That's all we're talking about here. He was only a paedophile then. He was only a paedophile then. This is before he was an international sex trafficker. And they include a variety of things like Mandelson encourages him to fight for early release and Mandelson stayed at his flat. They tried to get him to help him broker a business deal in 2010. Starmer is under that kind of pressure that no politician wants, which is what did you know and when did you know it sort of thing. I think another question though is, how did they ever appoint the guy, right? At the point where it was in the public domain, it was, that Mandelson continued to be friends with Epstein after he was a paedophile, basically, a convicted paedophile. That was like, well, that's out there now. We've had that discussion and he still gets brought into government. That's my issue, is to forget like whether all the other stuff was known. How the fuck does that guy get back into public life?
Peter Kyle, the business secretary, got sent round at the weekend, didn't he, to answer the questions on this.
Oh, that guy.
Well, yeah, I know, but they're running out of people, aren't they?
Yeah.
Angela Rayner's gone. Who'd you send? No one wants to do it. Do you know what I mean? David Lammy's calling that one in sick. No one wants to have to go out and back this.
Yeah, do you reckon Lammy did it like really snipey? Or maybe send your deputy.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm just a deputy. Send out Peter Kyle.
No, I mean, you know, I'm clearly not important enough to be sent out to defend you on being pals with the pedo guy. Peter Kyle's whole thing over the weekend, he kept saying he's like, he had singular skills, Mandelson. He had singular skills. No one else can do what this guy can do. They're talking about him like he's a set piece specialist. Do you know what I mean? It sounds like Rory Delap. It's like, look, he's got a long throw. No one else can deliver a ball into the box like that. You might not like him defensively, but look, he's going to give us something no one else can give us. And they didn't really press him on it. They were like, well, what's he done? What are these special skills? And the main thing he came out with was like, look, our relationship with America was really bad. And then Mandelson came in and it's improved. And you go, has it? Or was it?
Is the other question, because everyone said that Karen Pearce, who was in the job before, was really good. So you've let someone go who, by the way, whose nickname was the Trump Whisperer.
This is it,
It's like you've let Declan Rice go for being good at free kicks to bring in Rory Delap, who's good at long throws.
It is quite funny that you got rid of like someone who was professionally known as the Trump Whisperer, who was clearly good at that. Bring in Mandelson, you go, well, what? How could Mandelson have such a strong relationship with Trump? And then you think, well, to be fair, they may well have been on the island together at the same time. So that might be why they get on.
There is that possibility. Yeah, it's like, forget, yeah, Trump Whisperer, you're done. Pedo Whisperer, get warmed up, you're coming on.
Yeah. What
must people think? So certain Labour MPs, look, quite a few backbenchers are now starting to talk. And Richard Bergen, friend of the show. But look, everything I say about Richard Bergen comes with a caveat. I don't think he's the greatest political thinker we've ever had of our time, but he's certainly on the harder left, a figure that people listen to. And he said, now you might think that he'd come out and say Starmer's got to go now, but I think somewhat strategically, he said that Starmer, you know, if things go badly at the local and Scottish elections in May 2026, then maybe he's got to go. Now you sort of think, well, that seems quite long range, but then you go, but he definitely will do badly in those elections. So what Richard Bergen has effectively said, it's not a, well, let's see how it goes. It's a, right, that's the date that we get rid of Keir Starmer. And it's quite smart because it's a pin in the map. And it's like, right, let's get our shit together by May 2026 and get rid of him.
In terms of predicting the events that are coming, because I'm kind of with you, like following the Rayner thing, following this that's going on with Mandelson now, the Trump visit's going to go badly. There's nothing good coming up for Starmer, which is like an easy win for him. Do you think we go into the summer, he struggles in those elections and we get a leadership contest with someone taking over from him? Do you think there's any risk of some kind of general election over next year?
I don't think they'll have a general election. They've got too big a majority and they're not obliged to do it. You know, the Tories change leaders so many times. But I think that the problem for the people on the left is that Andy Burnham is the best placed in terms of profile to take over. But he says he don't want it, but he materially wouldn't be as different, right? You know, he's again from the centre left. So maybe they're giving themselves time to pick. Because I would think that if I was a like hard left Labour MP, what I'd be thinking is this might be our last chance for a while to do a bit of socialism, right? It's probably never going to happen again. We've got 170 seat majority. It is like we could do 3 years of proper scorched earth socialism. You know what I mean? Get all the millionaires out, not just some of them. So let's give ourselves enough time to do it. And that's where the weird thing is with Starmer. It's like, I think he's very poor, but equally, I can also see that if he does go, the alternatives might be worse.
All of the alternatives are worse. All of them are worse. I kind of disagree with you on Burnham, because I think the thing is, as much as he's centre-left and Starmer's centre-left, a lot of the sort of like tidy, like unspoken centre-left things that Starmer's done haven't been that bad. But it's when he starts trying to drift towards like right wing stuff that he feels unconvincing, and that's where it's failed. If someone just came in and did centre left but actually just did it properly, stuck to it and didn't tweet about migrants four times a day, I think they would actually just get on along with people.
Well, you'd have a sense of some consistency. And speaking of consistency, it's really weird with the press have taken a long time to come round to the fact that Starmer might be a bit shit, right? Because the centrist press were like, he's our guy, grown-ups are in the room, hate the Tories, all that stuff. With Starmer, I was sort of thinking, when was he good? Like, you know, under Corbyn, he, you know, seemed to turn a blind eye to certain things to do with anti-Semitism. You know, he wasn't as vocal as maybe as he could have been, continued to serve in that government. He would say, well, it's better to be there to influence people. But still, though, there's questions asked about that, right? You know, becomes leader. He struggles to get any cut through whatsoever until Partygate. Then that just lands in his lap. And then, like, the lawyer tells off the liar for, like, a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did that quite well. But, you know, how could you not? And then in the election campaign, you know, it's basically, the win is an inheritance. It's almost like a trust fund baby, the Labour Party under Starmer. They get given this win because the Tories kept fucking machine gunning their own legs off, right?
So
in the election campaign, he's a bit shit. In all the debates, he's a bit shit. He's shown poor judgment in government. I'm sort of, people are acting like he's wildly changed. I actually think he's been pretty consistent.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Okay, just a quick hype. I sure should have said it at the start of the show. Tour starts this week, first show, Thursday in Tring. There's a few tickets left for that. Saturday, Bristol, sold out. The Sunday in Bath Comedia, we sold quite a few, but it's a big venue. So it is starting. There are some big rooms as well I'm doing. Reading, I'm doing the Birmingham Comedy Festival, Birmingham Town Hall. Already over 400 there, but it's a big room. Let's get some more in there. And a few people have been moaning that I've got no dates in the Northwest. Keep scrolling. Right? When you go on that Live Nation link, just keep scrolling to 2026 and you'll see that I'm doing Salford and the Chorley Theatre as well. So Basic Bloke 2, it's starting and I hopefully see you out there. Get yourself to Live Nation. And Jacob, you got any live dates? Anything for the podcast you want to plug?
I've got my own podcast, the Screen Rock podcast, me and another very funny comedian discussing all things social media, taking the mick out of those annoying people you'll have seen on your algorithm recently. We're doing some live shows. A lot of them are sold out, but we've got about 10% of tickets left for the Shepherd's Bush Empire at the end of January. So if anyone knows that pod, has listened to it before, get yourself along. 31st of Jan, Shepherd's Bush Empire.
And Screen Rock podcast is very good. And the thing is, you don't need to know who the people are that the lads talk about. That's part of what's good about it, is you sort of unpack it. So if you're like me, you know, getting on towards 50, but you sort of want to find a vicarious way of staying in touch with what's happening online and the angles of comedy on it, then do listen to the Screen Rock podcast. Okay, so Ricky Hatton, sad news broke on Sunday that he'd been found dead at home, not yet 50. And the police said no suspicious circumstances, which I think normally means that it was either that he'd taken his own life or it was something to do with drugs, right? It's normally one of those two. A lot of people seem to think that he'd sadly taken his own life. And both of those things would class as what's called a death of despair, right? You've heard of this, Jacob, where people are increasingly saying, if you just look at suicide for men, that's a bad enough stat. But if you throw in kind of another version of that, which is where you drink or take drugs to an excess, those, you know, they kind of come under that umbrella, you know. And it's similar to somebody like Graham Thorpe. He'd spoken previously about suicidal thoughts and stuff. And listen, I know that, you know, talking about suicide is probably one of the saddest things you can do on a podcast, but I do think we need to mention it. But I think what was interesting to me about it was, for somebody like that, once you've achieved on such a high level, how you adapt to the life afterwards. Because I think there are a small percentage of athletes and sportsmen who become like pundits, and that seems to keep them excited. Punditry is the new thing, isn't it? It's where they can compete, they can get wins, they can get promotions. But if you don't fall into any of that stuff, you know, we know ourselves what it's like to gig, the adrenaline, the come down after that and stuff. Boxing must be on an absolutely different threshold.
Ricky Hatton, I'm a bit of a boxing fan myself, and Ricky Hatton's very much one of those boxers who, when I was like a young teenager, got me into the sport. But you think back to what Ricky was known as, it was full English breakfast between fights sometimes. It was, and he spoke about this himself, of like, he would almost feel guilty at times because he was worried that his friends thought of him as being out of touch and not hanging around with them anymore. So he'd get himself down the pub and almost be too keen to reconnect with a life that maybe an athlete doesn't live. I think the thing with boxing, like with football, you retire as a footballer. Every team now has got 20, 30 coaches. They've got academies. There's so many jobs within football where you can stay in it. With boxing, like Ricky did do so much stuff with younger fighters. His son Campbell's a fighter himself. But as you say, it's kind of transient. It comes and goes, the work. He had his own gym, but he wasn't always there. He spent a lot of time in Tenerife. And I think Ricky's someone who, he like one of the best boxers we've had in the last few decades. He was an icon of British boxing. But at the same time, you could see he's a working class lad who really felt the pull of remaining true to the way he grew up and who he was. And the truth is, the way he grew up, you're in and out of pubs. And especially with the world as it is now, and I know this from my friends from home and stuff, it's like pubs and class A drugs just go hand in hand now. No one blinks at that.
I mean, it's interesting you talk about like the binging between being fit for fights. I mean, we've seen it with Tyson Fury, you know, whether it's food, drink, drugs. There's a lot of examples now of boxers that are like this. Paddy the Baddy from UFC does a similar thing. I'm not insinuating that for him it's a chemical thing. He just loves eating and he gets fat and stuff like that. And it sort of reminds you that, like, the rigor and the mental punishment of getting in the shape that they do get in, it must be harder than we even realise, because the amount of them that between fights blow out suggests the pressure that staying in that shape puts on them.
Well, it's a routine that just isn't sustainable. You can't train like a boxer all year round. There are a few that do it. Sort of Anthony Joshua stays in shape. But like, it's not like football where whether you're on the bench, playing a match, whatever, you just train all year round. Over the summer, you'll see footballers go to individual camps and just train as they would during the season. And certainly when people retire, they kind of carry on. They run, they do the cardio, they do as they would do as a player. Boxing is such an intense sport, and it's that word intensity, as you say, the adrenaline rush of getting in the ring with a man in front of you who's, if you don't come at him, he's going to come at you. That's so intense. The training you have to do is so intense.
Yeah, like sometimes 10, 20, 30,000 people cheering as you're getting hit and you're hitting people. I don't think there's anything like boxing.
Anyone who's done any kind of white collar fight or even sparring, you'll know that rush, I've done it a couple of times, it is unbelievable. And we speak about the problems that Ricky had, be it with booze or partying and going out and stuff. And it's like, it's not difficult to make the link between trying to reach those highs again, trying to hit that level again. And I mean, the really like heartbreaking thing, Ricky was a family man. He was a grandfather as well as a father. And he leaves, you know, a family behind at such a young age. I think because he's been in the public eye for so long, you forget he's not even really in his late 40s. I think he was 47 years old.
I do think, you know, though, it brings up the idea of checking in, people checking in with their mates. And I'm, you know, a big advocate of that, and I talk about it. But I do also think, like, whenever I say that, I am aware of what blokes are like, right? You know, like, you'll probably have this where you have a mate that everyone knows they're struggling and you check it, or like something's gone wrong, the business has gone down or something like that. And you check in, you go, how are you doing? They go, good, mate, you? And you're like, I mean, like, well, then it's very difficult for blokes, because we're very respectful of each other's privacy, aren't we? Women aren't like, women will go past that barrier. But for a bloke, it's a very big deal to then say, look, I feel like you're not, I know you're not, to then go past that next level. And so that, I absolutely echo that message about checking in. But equally, you do have to sometimes acknowledge that it's not as easy as just saying, how are you, or going for coffee. Because if they don't want to tell you what's really wrong, you know, we're not trained professionals. I don't know. What do you think? Is it different with your generation?
It's the same, mate. I sort of did that checking in thing with a pal of mine recently. He lives in Scotland. I was like, how's it going, mate? And he did what you'd want. He goes, yeah, actually, really not good. I mean, I'm not naming it, doesn't matter. Him and his missus having like fertility problems, trying for a kid, been trying for a while. He's like, yeah, it's just really hard. We're really struggling. Waiting list on the NHS is a long time. Don't know what to do. And I read it back for about 10 minutes being like, I've got no idea how to respond to that. I don't know what to say.
I think blokes sometimes struggle with the platitudes, right? Because we feel like if we say something obvious back, that will seem like we don't care or we haven't thought it through. But actually, I think what women are better at doing is just saying the obvious thing.
Well, empathising, not just trying to offer a solution. Immediately, I'm going, right, could he go private? What would that cost? Blah, blah. It's like, no, he doesn't want a solution. He wants someone to listen to him and just understand that it must be shit. But I think we're minded practically to go, well, can I offer you money, mate?
Yeah, you're putting together a little Word doc with like loads of links. Here's this. I found this. Yeah. Like, I've heard this podcast, mate, about fertility is fucking amazing.
This supplement will help. Yeah, that'll get him swimming. You just try and fix it without just listening.
Suddenly you're sending him zinc fucking capsules on Amazon when really all you need to do is say, oh, that's shit.
Yeah.
If, you know, we can have a chat if you want. Okay, right. For everybody else, it will be the end of the show now. But for patrons, we're going to be discussing sort of Jacob's take on the fallout to the Charlie Kirk murder. And we're going to do a little bit on the Unite the Right march, which happened on Saturday. Jacob, that was an interesting chat, man. Covered a lot of ground in that patron-only section. So if people want to hear it, they can sign up. And if you have any thoughts as patrons, remember, I'm sure we kind of went a lot of different ways in that chat. Then remember, you can DM me through the Patreon website and I can respond to it in subsequent episodes. So Jacob, just remember your podcast, the Screen Rot podcast. You're doing these live shows. You've already done some and people seem to love them. So people do get tickets for that. And thanks very much for appearing on this week's show. Are you going to say anything?
Oh, sorry, I didn't know if you wanted to come back. Tonally, the way your voice went at the end of that felt like the end of the episode. So I didn't know if I was supposed to respond.
No, all right. Jacob, thanks very much for being on this week's show.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.